You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 4th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Buenos noches.
Buenos noches.
I'm sorry, what language were you attempting there?
Buenos nachos.
Spanish. Happy Cinco de Mayo plus dos.
It's Cinco de Cuatro.
Well, right today's now. Cinco de Cuatro. People are listening to this on
Cinco de Cuatro.
Cinco.
You mean Cuatro de Mayo.
You guys are
funny. Right. What do I look like? Spanish? I don't know.
Do any of you guys like Cinco de Mayo?
Well, I do know that Cinco de Mayo is most popular amongst white Americans, more so than any Mexican who has ever lived.
You need to qualify that even further, Rebecca.
White frat boy.
Yes, thank you.
That's not to say I won't be drinking a margarita and eating tacos tomorrow, but honestly, I do that every day. So,
I honestly don't know what it's celebrating or commemorating. Evan, I'm sure
you're going to tell us. Well, it commemorates a war. I think it's a French-Mexican war, isn't it?
Who won?
Mexico? Woo-hoo. Since they celebrate it?
Yeah, they're like, let's celebrate. We got kicked our asses this time.
Yeah. O-M-G. Obviously, as a stupid white American, I don't know all the details. But yeah, I believe that it was a battle that Mexico wasn't likely to win, that they did, in fact, win.
What about Siete de Mayo, Evan?
Yes, Siete de Mayo. Thank you, Steve. Scientific advancement, standards for medical education, launching a program of medical ethics, and improved public health. These were and are the goals of the American Medical Association, founded or established on this day in 1847.
And that's why we celebrate with tacos and margaritas.
So dramatic.
Well, I read that right off their website. So, I mean, you know, they're the ones being dramatic. Not
self-congratulatory at all. The thing that's funny about the American Medical Association is that, first of all, it's a professional organization. It's basically a trade organization. They exist to promote physicians as a profession, but also the public health, and, you know, they do, you know, publish ethical guidelines, etc. But the one thing that the AMA doesn't do is regulate the practice of medicine. They actually they are not an official regulatory body. You don't even have to be a member of the AMA. They have absolutely no power over any physician or their license.
Yeah, they're not a government agency. It's an organization. It's a private collection of physicians.
But I can't tell you how often I get emails or comments from people who are paranoid or critical of the medical establishment, and they tend to focus on the AMA as if they establish the marching orders for physicians. And it's just completely disconnected from reality. They have no regulatory power.
Right. It's like going to the NRA to talk about gun laws that are actually being passed. No, the NRA is a lobbying group that promotes their agenda of trying to keep the Second Amendment, as far as they describe it, you know, pure. The AMA is a similar kind of organization.
Can I just give points to Evan for the most inflammatory analogy?
Well, they both end with A. I mean.
Cinco de Mayo.
That's a good choice.
Mexican War.
All right, this episode is going to set new records for the number of emails we get.
All right, let's then back up a couple of days to Cuatro de Mayo, May 4th, 2005. What happened on that date?
Star Wars Day?
Yeah, May the 4th be with you.
That is May the 4th be with you. That's true. What else?
Oh, duh.
What is this, a quiz?
Just Jay. Us. SGU.
That's right. Oh. The first SGU episode.
It was our first birthday.
This is 6 years.
Yeah, I wasn't born.
Of the
Holy
SGU.
Crap.
Yeah, this is pre-Rebecca. PR.
PR.
This was us going, hey, let's try this podcast thing. Okay.
Hey, I love 500 listeners. Woo.
Yeah, and about 15 seconds into it, that's when hello was born.
hey.
It was.
I think I mention this every year, but I love listening to that first episode because it's like, Perry, adjust your mic. Adjust your mic, Perry. It's like, what?
Oh,
I don't understand.
I fixed that. But yeah, I'm sure a lot of people have the old
copies out there.
But yeah, I have good news, everyone.
What? Yes?
We were picked up for another year.
Oh,
so
hey.
We have to do another year of the SGU.
Outstanding.
Wow.
I was so worried I wouldn't be able to make rent.
Yeah, we haven't signed all of your contracts yet. We're still negotiating.
Oh.
Some of you might not make it, but...
You're going to replace me with a 6-year-old boy, aren't you?
Steve, I didn't find my green Reese's Pieces today in my computer room, so I'm going to have to renegotiate.
Okay.
I got you all gifts for this anniversary.
You did?
Do you know what the traditional gifts are for the 6th-year anniversary?
Is that the tellurium?
Paper airplane.
That's close, Jay, actually. Closer than I thought anyone would get. No, iron and sugar.
How is that close to paper airplane?
How is that close?
You're just trying to make me feel better. Come on.
Exactly. It's paper is a commodity of sorts, and iron and sugar are also commodities.
Iron and sugar. There. I made you a cake there with a file in it. That's for your 6th-year anniversary in jail.
Now, here's what I got you guys, all right? The price of a dry metric ton of iron today is roughly $1.50. All right.
Really? $1.50 a metric $1.50. Ton?
Yep, for a metric ton.
What?
Of iron.
Of iron?
Compared to just a metric sugar, ton. Compared to sugar, which closed the day today at $21 per 100 pounds of sugar. So I figure for about $20 each, I can either get you 100 pounds of sugar or what? About 12 metric tons of
metric tons
but
of
what,
iron.
Guys,
but, yeah, but what's the shipping cost?
Shipping cost.
What's the shipping cost?
That's okay.
You could build yourself one hell of a zombie fortress with that, but getting it to your property is almost impossible.
That's okay. I bought it all, shipping point, which means that I shipped it out and you'll be getting the bills for it. So.
Oh, gotcha.
Okay.
You're welcome. So, I pay for the gift. You just handle the shipping.
So iron is that common, huh?
Actually, I just checked, and that's the price for iron ore, not the price for refined iron. Well, happy 6-year anniversary, everyone.
Yeah. Yay.
Yes, to all of you.
It's worth every second of it, guys.
6 years, 303 episodes.
303. Wow. How many downloads?
Well, yeah, that's a good speaking question. Of which, yeah, we are fast approaching 22 million all-time downloads.
What?
22 million served.
That can't possibly be right.
That's a lot of downloads.
We need a McDonald's sign. Someone's got to come up with a graphic of the big McDonald's sign and say 22 million served.
Yeah.
Awesome, guys.
For individual episodes, we're over 200,000 downloads per week of all episodes, but for individual episodes, we're approaching 90,000.
So which was the most popular episode?
Right now, the episode with the most downloads, I think just because... You know, you look at the pattern in the downloads, it's generally increasing, but it takes a couple of months for episodes to peak. So right now, the episode from February 23rd has the most downloads, 89,445.
Wow. These numbers do not include our radio listenership.
These numbers do not include our XM listenership. That's true. It's a tack on another 8,000 or so. So I guess that means we're approaching 100,000. What we need to do is to have our loyal listeners out there make a concerted effort over the next few weeks to get at least one other person to listen to the podcast on a regular basis.
Like a pyramid scheme.
Yeah, let's make a big push. Let's push and get over 100,000. By the way, that episode, the episode with the most downloads, was the one where Joshy Berger was a guest rogue.
Not surprised.
Hey. Oh, God.
Right. Yeah. Could have something
no surprise. No surprise there.
Josh is incredibly funny, and he's like that in real life. You know, he's even funnier in real life.
Yeah. He's got the fame. He's got the chef fame going for him.
Yeah.
Right? That's right.
Yeah.
But seriously, we are zeroing in on 100,000, and there's two good reasons why we need to break that barrier and get over 100,000.
100,000 a week, you mean?
Not for an individual episode. We're over 200,000 total downloads per week. But I'm just talking about just one episode, how many total downloads it gets. So one is that 100,000 is a completely arbitrary numerical barrier, and we're obsessed with those. But two, and this is the really important reason, Phil Plait just broke past 100,000 Twitter followers.
We can't
have him have more Twitter followers than we have people downloading.
We can't have a Phil Plait gap, Steve.
Right. Mm-hmm. We cannot allow a Phil Plait gap.
Fill the plate gap.
Right. You know what I'd like to know? For our, sorry, go ahead, Rebecca.
I was just complaining. How could he have that many followers? I only have 15,000, but go on. Go on. I'm over it.
Phil effing plate. I would love to know if there's anyone exceptionally famous that listens to our show.
Well, yeah, we've had a few people.
If you're famous or think you are and you listen to our show, contact us.
And anyone who writes in and isn't famous enough will respond with snide remarks. Oh, yeah, go right. away. You're not famous.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Khloe Kardashian, I'm talking to you.
we'll play you a file of get away from me, kid. You're bothering me.
W.C. Fields.
Who would you guys love to listen to our show?
Well, the thing I really love about our
Johnny
show is
Depp.
That a bunch of people Ooh. Listen to us who might not be famous, but they have these amazing skills or, you know, they work for ridiculous companies, like, you know, the Pixar guys.
Yeah, yeah.
We know that Pixar people listen, or the Weta Workshop people who I had the chance to meet. Those guys were so awesome.
Or the Sydney Opera House, or Houston Control.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the fact that we appeal to
Jimmy Carter's
a broad
grandson.
Base of nerdy people.
I will.
I would love for Myron Getman from Troy, New York to listen to our show.
Who's that?
I just picked a random email that we got over the last couple of weeks.
I guess
Myron, thanks for listening.
I guess knowing that Christopher Hitchens even knew that we existed beyond the interview we did with him 4 years ago would be really cool.
Do we know that?
Well, yeah, because he came to my parties.
That's a pretty low threshold for him, though. All right, well, let's move on to the rest of the show. We're past our 6-year congratulatory phase. We have a lot of news items to get through. The first one has to do with the Easter Island controversy. You guys aware of the raging controversy surrounding Easter Island?
Yeah, of course.
I am now.
Yeah, they want to rename it Christmas Island. it's an outrage. An outrage.
Spring seasonal island.
Do you guys know what the native or the Polynesian name for Easter Island is?
Yeah.
Rapa Nui?
Rapa Nui.
Yeah. Rapa Nui, yeah.
And Merry New Year to you, too.
Which I think means Big Rapa, Rapa being some other island that's not as big that looks similar. Hmm. But yeah, that's the Polynesian name.
How uncreative.
And, yeah. Do you guys know what the Easter Island heads are called?
Rapa heads.
Easter Island heads.
There's an actual name for them.
That's the name, the Easter Island heads.
It begins with an N.
Yeah, the creepers.
Yes.
They're called Moai.
Moai. Oh. M-O-A-I.
M-O-A-I, Moai. Yeah. So here's the skinny on Rapa Nui. The Polynesian colonists colonized the island sometime between about 400 and 1200 CE, probably closer to 1200. The more recent estimates from carbon dating and archaeology seem to be moving towards the later part of that range, so say 11 to 1200 CE. And then it was first discovered by Europeans in 1722 on Easter Day, hence the name, by a Dutch explorer.
Jacob Roggeveen. Roggeveen.
At the time that they were discovered by the Europeans. The population was about 3,000, you know, natives living on the island. And the question was that culture, was the people that were encountered capable of creating and moving these large stone heads, you know, these statues?
With the assumption being that if they weren't, then it was aliens?
No, with the assumption that if they weren't, then they may have had a larger, more elaborate culture in the past.
Oh,
And that the culture was already in decline by the time they were encountered by the Dutch.
Right.
After the Europeans encountered the Rapa Nui, what is uncontroversial is that the population was completely ravaged by their contact with the rest of the world. They were stolen as slaves. They were given smallpox and other diseases. They were murdered. So the population reached its low point in the late 19th century of about 111 individuals. And of them, only 36 had descendants. Right now, today, there are several thousand Rapa Nui, all descended from those 36 individuals at that bottleneck in the late 19th century.
Where do they live?
Yeah.
On the island. I mean, there are some that are also living elsewhere in the world, but most of them are living on the island.
Do they look like the statues?
Full-blooded.
They don't look like
statues. Yeah, they have enormous heads. Tiny little bodies.
Guys, let me tell you what I heard about the mythology of Easter Island, and didn't know it was wrong until because of researching this article. I heard that they cut down all the trees to move the statues to the ocean so they could, you know, ward off visitors. And that because they cut down the trees, they basically killed themselves by destroying part of their ecosystem.
Well, Jay, that is the controversy.
That's the controversy right there.
Did they destroy themselves? So, for example, was there really a bigger culture, say, of 12 to 15,000 at their heyday before they encountered the Dutch or the Europeans? And then they destroyed themselves by ruining the ecosystem of the island and civil war. Also, what's interesting was another element that may have harmed the population has to do with the mythology behind the Easter Island heads, the Moai. So it actually wasn't – those heads were not for warding away intruders or whatever.
Weren't they used as currency?
No.
Or something?
They honored the leaders.
No, I thought that there – maybe I'm thinking of another.
Rebecca, do you think they had like little ones that were worth less? Well,
no, there is a tribe somewhere that used some ridiculous large thing as currency that you couldn't move around, and they would just like – it would just be like, oh, you know that big thing on the side of the road? That's mine, so I'm wealthy. I swear I'm not making this up.
All right, but that's not here.
Okay.
So they were ancestor worshippers, and they believed that the living lived in a symbiotic relationship with the dead, that the dead watched over the living and provided, you know, food and prosperity, and the living honored the dead and gave them a better place in the afterlife, in the spirit world.
And I think that's why they face inward.
Yes, they,
right, as opposed to outward.
All of the Easter Island heads face in. They have their back to the ocean. And they are facing the villages that are along the coast and watching over them. That's why they're mainly lining the shore, but again, with their back to the ocean and facing inward at the settlements. However, a cult sprung up around the time of the European contact with the Rapa Nui, the Birdman cult. You know, and where individuals were saying that the people don't get their power and prosperity directly from their ancestors. They get it through individuals who were invested with power from, and I guess that person was the Birdman. It's like some kind of a holy warrior. And that started a lot of fighting among the Rapa Nui. And you know what they did to really piss off another tribe?
Poop on them from above, like the majestic bird?
They killed their Birdman?
They knocked over their heads, their Easter Island heads, their Moai.
They're basically like high school students.
Yeah. So,
wait, I thought they were all like Weebles that kind of wobble, but they can't fall down.
Over time, almost all of the heads on the island were knocked over because of this civil war.
See what happens?
So, yeah, and they were also killing each other. So this was the civil war that was going on.
Oh,
it was
that,
actually
yeah.
provoked by a cult that arose among... Hmm. On the island. But now the question is, did the cult and the civil war and the knocking over the heads predate contact with the Europeans, or was it a result of cultural contamination from them? The evidence that is cultural contamination is that there were also bird cults in Hawaii, and the petroglyphs of the Birdman are identical, apparently, in Hawaii and Rapa Nui. So they think, well, that was just imported from Europeans, so it was after contact. So essentially, Jared Diamond, you know him, he's the guy who wrote...
Yeah, Collapse.
Collapse. He wrote about
Germs and Steel.
He was saying that the society collapsed internally because of civil war, because they destroyed all the trees on the island in their head production industry, and they were... you know, a remnant population by the time they were encountered by the Europeans. But now there's a new book coming out There are dissenters from that opinion by Carl Lippo of California State University and Terry Hunt of the University of Hawaii. Their book, The Statues That Walked, Unraveling the Mystery of Easter Island, they argue that the Rapa Nui were doing just fine until the Dutch got there. And then and they were capable of creating those heads by themselves. But then it was the disease and slavery and such, that contact with the outside, that destroyed them. They said that even though they did deforest the island, that they were actually, there weren't that many trees there to begin with, and they didn't really depend upon them. They think that they were engaged in what's called a stone mulching, which you can take, like, grind up volcanic rock and infuse it into the soil in order to add nutrients. And they think their agriculture was just fine without the trees, and that wasn't the reason why their population was so reduced. So that's the raging controversy.
Plus, they didn't need the trees to transport them, right? Because they think they were just kind of rocking them to move them.
They think the way two guys would move a huge refrigerator. They would leverage it and rock it. Yeah, and that. So the fewer people.
These things are
they're huge, but if you know what you're doing, you wouldn't need that many people, I guess, to move them around.
Yeah.
So that's the controversy. By the way, do you know in the Rapa Nui mythology, the god that created the people was called Maki Maki. And do you know what the other significance of that name is?
That's fish, isn't
Maki
it?
Maki Maki. It's Mahi Mahi.
It's Mahi Mahi. Oh, that's right. Maki Maki. Maki Maki is one.
Kili Kili?
Is one of Kili Kili? The five dwarf planets. Can you name the other four?
Is it? Eros?
Eris.
Eris, Pluto.
Pluto, of course.
Ceres.
Ceres, yep.
Ceres, yeah.
Maki Maki,
Happy.
And then...
Doc.
Beetlejuice. No, that's a star.
Haumea.
Ah, I wouldn't have gotten
Haumea,
that.
Which is egg-shaped. It's not even really round.
Too small.
But it has two moons.
Fascinating.
Those are the five dwarf planets. Yep, one of them is the god of creation for the Rapa Nui. Let's move on.
Mystery solved.
Mystery solved. Now, it's still a controversy. There's no solution to this at this point.
It's closed.
All right.
That's good. It's good because it's a real scientific controversy.
Yes,
not
it is.
Phony baloney BS.
All right. The next news item is one of those good news, bad news sort of things. The good news is that Osama bin Laden is dead. That is the good news. The bad news is that there already is conspiracy theories proliferating around the event of his death.
Right. I mean, Steve, is he dead? Is he really?
I haven't seen his body.
Exactly. Yes. On Monday night, Obama announced that U.S. forces had found and killed Osama bin Laden. Immediately, this launched 8,000 new conspiracy theories, particularly amongst the Tea Party movement and the 9/11 conspiracy theorists, both of whom tend to hate the government. I actually did go on the 9/11 Truther forums, and I saw people almost immediately dismissing the news by saying that bin Laden was actually secretly killed years ago and was just now being used as some kind of election fodder, yeah. Despite the fact that the election is a year and a half away. It's never too early to plan. And remember that from the 9/11 Truther standpoint, bin Laden was at best just a patsy. And at worst, just a sort of assistant to the U.S. Mm-hmm. government that was really killing all of its citizens.
So here's the thing. Let me ask you one question. Because this always happens when there's a big political worldwide news event. There's always somebody that says, oh, isn't the timing convenient? Because it's going to help so-and-so in an election, or it's going to take attention away from this other thing that's happening. Let me ask you a question. Is there ever, ever a time when you couldn't think that it was convenient for someone that there was a big distracting news item?
Yeah, and it's a good point. And what I've been seeing a lot with this particular news item is, isn't it convenient that Obama announced this in the middle of Celebrity Apprentice? because Donald Trump is supposedly running for president, even though we all know he's not. And come on, seriously. we're still supposed to pretend as though he's a valid candidate and that Obama cares. So Obama obviously orchestrated this entire thing and then launched it during Celebrity Apprentice to mess with Donald Trump.
I know. Crazy. That was so ridiculous. And the article that Steve links to, I suppose that's the one you'll link to in the show notes, Steve. Whoever wrote it kind of wrote it in a sense, in the way that they have here. Let's see. The campaign theory was given extra credence by the fact that the U.S. president's announcement, blah, 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 into Donald Trump's reality show. It's like, really? I mean, really given right. more credence because of that?
And at what point could that news come out and not interrupt something Donald Trump was doing on television? It would be literally impossible. Oh, you did that just when Donald Trump went on The View. Yeah.
Sure. just when he drifted off to sleep.
Because if it wasn't for that, Donald Trump totally would have won the presidency in 2012. That's what they're going to be saying years from now. Sure. Yeah.
So the idea here, though, is that people are saying it wasn't a coincidence that he said it during the show?
Correct. Yeah, they're saying there are no coincidences when it comes to conspiracy theories, Jay. You know, we know by now that they specifically seek out evidence to support their theory that they've already formulated in their heads. And so in this case, the theory is this was all a big scheme to, you know, secure Obama the presidency, to reinforce the idea that 9/11 was the fault of terrorists, whatever your conspiracy of choice happens to be. And things were made much worse the following day when, by which time it was revealed that the U.S. military buried the body at sea in accordance with Muslim customs. This, of course, from the U.S. standpoint, was done as a way to avoid terrorists responding, attempting to get hold of the body in some way by using terroristic threats. But from the conspiracy theorist standpoint, that was actually to avoid presenting any kind of evidence.
They also didn't want to create a shrine.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. A place people could go to right,
exactly.
to worship.
Right. And also, there have been no photos released yet. According to the U.S., that is because half of bin Laden's face was blown off, and the photos are too gruesome to reveal to the public. From the conspiracy theorist standpoint, this is, again, a way to avoid evidence. Yeah, how convenient.
Yeah. And as of today, Cuatro de Mayo, Obama announced that that he's not going to release the pictures. Who knows what's going to happen in the next few days or weeks, but that's what he
right.
said today.
Yeah, and I understand not wanting to put gruesome photos on the front page of the newspaper, but we do live in the information age. And, you know, we were talking about this earlier and someone mentioned that WikiLeaks was probably not far from getting the photo and publishing it soon anyway. So yep. I suppose we'll see. But in the meanwhile, the U.S. has presented its evidence by saying that it has that we have DNA evidence that this is Osama. Mm-hmm. The response from the conspiracy theorists has been that's impossible because they've watched enough Sally Jesse and Mari Povich to know that DNA tests take weeks to find out who's the daddy. luckily, there was a really great article written by Christy Wilcox, who is a science grad student and a blogger. She writes Observations of a Nerd over at Science Blogs. She wrote a really great detailed overview of how long it would take to do a DNA test using equipment that you can find in just about any lab. And here's what she came up with. To just extract the DNA, she figured 15 minutes. Amplifying the DNA sequence is the next step.
PCR?
That's basically making millions of copies, of a single piece of DNA.
Chain reactions?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Cool.
And she said that would take 3 hours at most. Next up is genotyping, which is basically forming a fingerprint. And then you lay it on top of your target's quote-unquote fingerprint and compare the peaks and valleys and see how it matches up. She says that this would take 1 hour or less. So all told, less than 5 hours total using equipment available to most labs. That discounts some super fast process that the FBI, CIA, whoever may have perfected.
They could do it in a nanosecond.
The reason the Jesse Raphael watchers out there and the Mari Povich watchers out there, folks, it takes all those weeks because those people who are having DNA tests are not Osama bin Laden.
Right.
Well,
exactly.
That's some police department somewhere
off-site.
Probably 5-year-old equipment.
Or off-site, sending it off-site.
Or they're sending it out or something. Yeah, I mean, that's why.
What Christy suggested was that the thing that would take the most time in this case is simply moving the sample to a lab. Who knows where they have you know, a secure lab to do this test. But it's safe to say that once it gets to the lab, it's being done with 100% of the attention of the staff on duty and with top of the line equipment. So less than 5 hours this could be done. So it's not completely out of the question to say that they would have DNA confirmation within 24 hours. And, you know, one question I had is, well, what do they compare the DNA to? Let's say they don't have DNA of Osama bin Laden on hand.
Family.
Osama bin Laden had about 5 billion siblings. So one of whom, a half-sister, just died in Boston fairly recently. So the government did confirm, I believe, that they compared it to familial DNA that they had on record and found a match. So it was either Osama bin Laden or another sibling.
Joey bin Laden?
Right. Like
O.J. Simpson?
You have to assume that that sibling would have had to have looked exactly like Osama and been on a dialysis machine in Abbottabad this week at the same time as Osama bin Laden. The chances of that are pretty small. So, of course, you know, at the end of the day, though, you really have to just trust the government because the government isn't going to release the DNA results in such a way that you could test it at home. So this is one of those situations where you do have to have trust in an authority. And there are thousands of people out there who will never trust this government in particular, and some of them who will never trust any government in general. And so these conspiracy theories will unfortunately continue to abound until the end of time, regardless of how much evidence is presented.
True. But Rebecca, there's even the most silly side to this whole conspiracy thing. And I think it's not the fact that bin Laden was killed years ago, but it was the fact that he was people are saying that he's not dead, that they didn't kill him. And to me, that is the most incredibly ridiculous. I mean, how easy would it be to disprove that? Hello, here I am. Hold up a paper, comment on current events, and make, you know, the United States look totally ridiculous. I mean, so that to me, that was the most egregious example.
Unless he's in on it, Bob.
Right. It's a lot like the claim that the moon landings were faked, and the counterclaim that, well, if they were, why didn't Russia call us on that?
Right. A good one. Yeah. A very good example.
You know,
why?
The Soviets were trying very hard, and they had everything to gain from proving that America
the one time I used that argument directly at a moon hoaxer, the response was, well, that's because they're all in on it.
Right. That's exactly the
Russians
and the
United States are all working for the real secret worldwide government. You know?
Right. If you're giving this that sort of counterclaim to a 9/11 truther, for instance, that will be the response because there are different flavors of 9/11 conspiracy theorists.
Well, that's the upper echelon of crazy. Absolutely.
Charlie
Sheen.
There are
talking.
A portion of them who believe that terrorists were involved, but only in collusion with the U.S. government. There are others who believe that no terrorists were involved at all and that it was all the U.S. government. You know, it's a wide spectrum of delusion. I feel like for the real dyed-in-the-wool conspiracy lovers, there's really no amount of evidence that's ever going to come close. And speaking of, I should also mention one other thing is that there was a photo made. That's going around the internet really, really quickly now. It shows a quote unquote dead Osama next to a photo of him alive, and it's clear that they're the same photo, just one has been photoshopped. That was actually made prior to all of this going down, and it was a confirmed Photoshop even before all of this went down. It's just what happened was people started immediately Googling dead Osama and looking at Google images, and this was one of the first thing that pops up. So even though it was created obviously as a Photoshop job ages ago, it's picked up and run as a current photo. So that's how easy it is for some crazy conspiracy thing to get out of control on the internet.
Oh yeah, that's the risk. Like when you make fake Nostradamus quatrains, someone's going to pick that up in 5 years and pass it along as legit. And you're like, man, look what the monster I created.
Can we just for one moment entertain
the idea that maybe they did fake it, right? I'm just as a mental exercise.
It's a hypothetical.
Hypothetical.
Which version, though? Is he really dead, or did they kill him years ago?
Yeah. No, let's say that he's not dead.
Okay.
Why would the government fake it, or the collective, you know, global government fake it?
For the election, for
boost our economy,
political gain,
morale.
Mm-hmm. Halliburton.
Yeah, all of these are
to
fuzzy.
Divert attention away from the horrific American Idol results.
To direct attention away from Obama's birth certificate, which he revealed to be a fact last week.
Oh, there's another image going through Facebook of Obama saying that picture of Obama, and it says, "Sorry it took so long to get you a copy of my birth certificate. Oh, yeah. I was too busy killing Osama bin Laden."
I do want to talk about being touched by a robot. Try not to get
show us
excited.
On the doll, Steve.
Yeah.
About let touching it, let robots. Jay,
yeah, this is a short item about a
I'm
recent study.
That we will stretch out in inexorably.
This is an item about a recent study that looked at how people would react to being touched by a robot.
Now, sexually?
Bob, I know Bob probably has been dreaming about his first robotic touch for years.
Bob,
right, Bob?
Bob's been doing his own personal research.
Hands-on research.
It needs
a little too much.
Yeah. I don't like cold metal.
But to Bob's utter surprise and shock, most people don't really sit around thinking what it's going to be like to have a robot reach out and touch you. It is kind of a cool and to some people might be a little scary idea about, you know, when humans start to physically interact with robots like this.
What do we mean by touch? And what do we mean by robot? Because I feel like we've been touching robots and robots have been touching us for a long time.
Well, it's more of a mindful touch, even though, you know, we can't say that any robots we have today are anywhere near close to having a real consciousness of any kind. But the idea that the robot would touch a human in a manner that humans touch humans and under certain circumstances. So, like one of the circumstances that they tested was, let's say that the robot is washing you or reaching out to wash you. And another circumstance they tested was, creepy. Let's say the robot was reaching out to comfort you. And they tested the subject's responses to these types of touching. And what they concluded was, well, before I say that, why don't you guys tell me what you think the human response was?
Disgust.
Embarrassment.
No, to which one, though? What did people tolerate being touched by a robot more if they thought it was going to wash them or if it was trying to comfort them?
Washing, I think, would be more tolerated than comfort.
I'm going to guess comfort.
It was actually washing. They think that the comfort one was weirder to the subjects because
it requires like a sympathetic response from the robot, right?
Well, it's not just the robot. I think it's just a built-in human response. They did the same study with nurses and they found that people did not react well in general to being touched out of comfort. And it was easier for them.
It's not part of the job. It's not part of the job. You know, it's washing you is part of the job, whereas comfort is kind of like is different.
You could argue about whether or not it's part of a nurse's job to comfort a patient. Regardless of that, I thought it was very interesting that people basically didn't want their personal space invaded. They didn't want to be touched. They didn't want to give up that little bit of privacy if it was just to be comforted. And it'd be interesting to explore exactly why that is. Maybe they didn't think it was genuine or they thought it was sort of, you know, this is a person that you don't have an intimate personal relationship with. They're just a professional you may be interacting with over just a short period of time. And it could be seen as inappropriate
I think primarily it's ridiculous. A robot comforting makes absolutely no sense at all. It's too canned. It's like that's.
But what's interesting is that the people's responses were the same to the robot and the nurse.
But my point stands with both of those. My point is that the thing that makes you uncomfortable is that it's a sympathetic response, and that works with both of those. For instance, when someone is just washing you, that's a purely physical action that they're doing. But to comfort someone requires being sympathetic, even empathetic at yeah. times, you know, relating to them on an emotional level. And so, yeah, I can definitely see. I don't like people touching me
in
cases like that.
Rebecca, though, I think the point here, not disagreeing with you at all, because I think your analysis here is correct, but the point of this was to determine if people are going to have a different response to a robotic touch versus a human touch. And
right.
the point of curiosity here is that the robot touched the test subjects in the same exact way, same pressure, same place, everything. So,
like a hand on the shoulder,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
Like patting someone on the back, something.
Yeah, so they just quizzed them afterwards to ask them what they felt. The researchers found that touch is perceived in line with what the subject believes the intent of the touch is.
Exactly, yeah.
So the perception of the touch was everything going into it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, but did people actually perceive it as a like a compassionate touch? Did they even think of it along those lines?
I would really like to have seen the hand or the thing of the robot that was touching the test subject to see if it was like a human hand or, you know,
like
where
was
it?
A saw of some kind.
Yeah, like a razor blade hook.
Kill all humans.
Well, it's funny you say that, Steve. They also studied. They also studied how people responded different. That's awesome, Steve. Well, vision just popped into my head like crazy. They also studied how people responded differently if the robot verbally told the test subject it was about to touch them.
Mm.
So, again, what do you guys think people preferred? Did they like to be told the robot was going to touch them before it did or not?
I'd say not. I'm going to touch you now.
Yeah, that for some reason, like the way danger, I'm imagining danger. It, that ups the creep factor considerably. I am about to touch you. Now I am touching you.
Is that how robots talk?
Yes,
do
you like
that's
it
how
if I touch you lower, lower? Yeah, but the result was that people did not like to be warned about the touch, and they could surmise or extrapolate from their responses that basically they agreed with you, Rebecca. It was a little weird to have the robot like suddenly alert you that they're going to touch you. It was just, you know, we're very used to being touched as humans. Like, we're social creatures.
Yeah.
It's just better to touch, to go for the touch than to announce it.
But I think the other layer here that's interesting is the similarity between people's yeah. response to the robot and people's response to humans. And I think that stems from the fact that we easily invest agency even in
exactly.
inanimate objects
yeah.
or in things
mm-hmm.
that are not genuinely alive. And we also easily personify them. So that's why, you know, you can respond to a cartoon character as if it has real human emotion. And, you know, you respond to a robot as if it has intent. And you infer its intent, and that affects how you respond to it. So I think this all means that when more, you know, human-like or lifelike robots are becoming more incorporated into our daily lives, how easily we're going to treat them as if they are living things.
Oh,
just,
yeah.
It seems just to be natural for us to do that.
Well, I showed you the video of that. Well, oh, maybe I didn't show you guys. I blogged about a video I saw of a very advanced robotic head that had really, really human-like facial gestures and shoulder
yeah.
gestures.
Is it the Swiss or Swedish or whoever researcher? It had like a stache and stuff.
Facial gesture.
I don't think it had a mustache. Stash. I don't remember.
There's one creepy looking.
So the Japanese woman.
Stash of
no, this
what?
Was a man. This was oh, a, yeah. it looked like a Caucasian man's face, but it did gestures with its face that for moments, very
for
brief
expressions,
moments,
not gestures.
I'm sorry. It did expressions with its face that for very brief moments, you get that feeling like it's a real person and you forget that it's a robot. Mm. And that was the first time I experienced that, and it was weird. Now,
oh, yeah.
I have another thing to say to you
really
guys.
Hardwired.
You ever at a restaurant and there's a leg underneath?
Once?
You guys are funny tonight. There's a leg underneath the table, and this happens to me all the time. I'll touch the table leg, and I'll think it's somebody else.
Mm.
Your brain makes you think it's the person sitting next to you that you're touching, and you perceive it as a human touch. And you might like quickly pull your leg away, you know, out of politeness to not invade the other person's space. Or even to me, stranger than that is when one time I was sitting next to my fiance and I thought it was her leg, and I actually like pushed into it a little more, and then I realized, oh, that's the table leg. And then it completely changed its perception in my head. It became an inanimate object, and it was harder than in my mind. It was a different feeling.
Yeah.
Ever have that happen?
No.
I've never been to a restaurant.
I had that feeling though of watching a robot and sort of almost forgetting that it's just a robot, in a much more primitive sense. The robot Keepon, I absolutely love him. If anyone wants to Google Keepon, he's just this little, like, he looks kind of like a marshmallow peep snowman. Like, he's very simple. He's just two little foamy balls, and he there's a video online of him dancing to Spoon's I Turn My Camera On, and he just like bops around, but the way he does it is really lifelike, and almost it would be eerie if I weren't so adorable. And I'm very excited because this was a robot that was a scientific experiment, like a proper scientist in the lab were working on this, and then they happened to put up this funny video where they were playing this song and he was bopping around, and it got so popular that it took off, and now they've developed a toy version that you can buy for like $30 that I think is coming out sometime soon. So I think that's kind of cool that a robot, like a sophisticated robot, has spawned a toy that we can all own.
Isn't it really weird that something Keepon looks like two yellow snowballs on top of each other with a little, face on it. And it does have some movements where you're like, there's a mind in there, you can kind of feel.
It's got two googly eyes and a little dot for a nose. That's it. It's very minimalist. Mm-hmm. It what is amazing is how something that is so minimalist can convey emotions with such little movement.
He tilts his little head and
it's not really surprising. I don't think it's very surprising.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's very interesting. But
and you can see
think
some
about kids who like put googly eyes on socks. Make little sock puppets or things, and kids will take it to bed and cuddle
what do you mean,
with it.
Kids, Jay is doing that right now.
Rebecca, come on.
So I think it's pretty deeply programmed from the time when we were little children.
And I think it's programmed from when our ancestors needed to pick a human face out of the jungle. It's the same effect that we see popping up all over the planet when people see Jesus in their French toast and things.
Delicious.
Yeah.
Well, this is
delicious,
interesting
and scientific.
Also, guys, because historically roboticists have been focusing on how to make robots safer and do their tasks, to do their jobs effectively, right?
Yeah.
Now we're moving into that area where we're seeing the use of robots really coming into its own now, where we can really start interacting with them. Robots could be used in healthcare. Robots can be used to take care of the old and infirm and everything. So now scientists are starting to see that we need to, with these more complicated and robust robots, that we have to actually work on the human to robot interaction much, much more closely and much more in a fine tuned way. We have to pay attention to this.
But what Keepon demonstrates though is that you don't have to look exactly like a person. You don't have to cross that uncanny valley and try to get something that looks indistinguishable.
Exactly what I was
human.
About to say, Steve. Yeah. In fact, I think
you could have these two ping pong balls and googly eyes and convey all the emotion that we would need to get.
And I think Keepon benefits from that because you're absolutely right in mentioning the uncanny valley. We haven't had a robot cross that yet, and that is the place where it looks human enough to freak you out.
Yeah, it's like an animated corpse.
Right.
It's
picture
creepy.
The Polar Express movie, or any
classic,
of those
classic example.
Similar movies. Yeah, it's so lifelike, but not lifelike enough, and it falls into the uncanny valley and it freaks you out. So I think for the most part, scientists right now are better off, those who are focusing on robots that can offer comfort, like Jay was just saying, in these roles that are meant to support humans and help humans in some way, they're probably better off avoiding those lifelike sort of monsters.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's why a lot of CGI movies nowadays have distorted characters because they want to avoid that, so they make the chin really big. They make features
like
really
huge.
So
yeah, like the big blobby people in WALL-E. Like WALL-E was such a beautifully done movie, but even they knew they couldn't make, you know, real looking humans.
Yeah, well, that's why the lead character was a robot.
Yeah.
If you've seen Asimo dance, especially a later version of Asimo, it's starting to move very lifelike now. It's doing human.
Asimo is the stand up one from like Honda or someone.
Right? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
it's pretty. Jay, but there's dancing robots, Jay, that are robots that are specifically designed to dance. And I've never seen Asimo dance like some of these other ones that are specific to that. They have moments where you're like. You feel like somebody's inside there, and they're clearly
exactly
camping.
Bob. That is creepy because what happens is you're not saying
I love
to
it.
Yourself the robot itself is animated. You think there's a person inside the shell. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yep. That's that agency,
a mechanical
agency
Turk
kicking in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mechanical Turk.
Right. But we're so attuned to body language.
And
body language breaks down to these little elements that can be conveyed by things that aren't, you know, indistinguishably human. So that's what we're seeing here. It's just you can convey these two ping pong balls can mimic something that we recognize as elements of body language that conveys meaning. Yeah. Evan.
Yes, sir.
How you doing?
No, I'm fine. How are you doing?
Good.
All right, quit the small talk.
All right. Who's
let's
that noisy?
Get to the big
Come
talk.
On. Let's go.
We need to hear last week's Who's That Noisy
All
first?
Right, let's hear
So
it.
Let's start with that.
This is maybe my favorite Who's That Noisy.
It's one of my favorites, too.
Pretty awesome.
There are a lot of interesting wrong guesses.
A lot of them.
Were there any interesting right guesses?
There were no right guesses whatsoever.
Oh, man.
Scooped them.
Excellent.
That means one of our listeners gets a prize.
That's right. Yes, Frances Forrest sent that in. She describes herself as a dedicated listener.
You call me Frances, I'll kill you.
Lighten up, Frances.
And you homos.
Try to get your meat hooks in, and I'll kill you.
I don't want you touching my stuff.
What the hell are you guys quoting?
Come on.
I don't even know.
Stripes.
Oh, yeah, Stripes?
It does predate
really?
You.
I used to love that movie.
1981, that movie was. Rebecca, why don't you do the reveal of exactly what that noise was?
It was one of the cutest animals in the world, the fennec fox.
Fennec fox.
It's so cute. It's got giant ears. The ears are bigger than its entire body.
And he's coming out with a hit CD next week.
And it's Francis's own fennec fox, because in some parts of the world, you can own a fennec fox as a pet.
Are they domesticated?
Well, apparently, you really have to know what you're getting into when you take on a fennec fox, because they are really hyper. Like, they're domesticated.
You've said their territory with Musk?
No, I don't think so. But they do. They make that noise you just heard. First of all,
it's a weird sort of noise.
They're
oh my God! Look at that thing. It's so cute.
Right? They are nocturnal, though. So
nocturnal.
Basically, that's they're going to be like flying around your home at night, making that noise, and they basically need to be like worn down. At all times.
So what you're saying is you need to live a lifestyle that is equivalent or in parallel with this fox. Otherwise, don't own
it. Like imagine having a border collie that's only interested in playing from like midnight to 6 a.m. That's like a fennec fox, wow. From what I gather.
Yeah, what is it about floppy ears?
Yeah, there's like a rule of cuteness that the you know, it's like a proportional thing, ears to total head size.
Well, look at a panda, though. It got tiny ears.
Wow. Well, that also it also works in reverse. What's important is that your ears not be proportional to your head size. Very tiny ears are cute. Very large ears are cute. Not in between.
This looks like a wingspan almost.
Wait a second.
At one point.
Wait a second. How come Ferengi aren't cute then?
Well, it's those files.
Because their teeth are all busted.
Yeah, I mean, there's other shit going on there.
They have ghetto teeth.
Plus, their ears are erogenous zones, which is kind of freaky.
Yeah.
And they secreted.
I'm sure something. Somewhere out there in cyberspace, there's a group of people dedicated to thinking that Ferengi are sexy.
Probably. They're like worse than furries.
So it's like a Ferengi fetish?
I shouldn't say that because I know for a fact that we have furry listeners. Love you guys.
Of course we do.
How do you know that?
I know that because I've met them. I have met furry listeners.
And they introduced themselves and said, I listen to your show and I'm a furry.
Pretty much.
Okay.
Furries tend to do that.
I think what happened,
Steve,
is they said, we listen to your show and we want you to be a furry.
Right. I mean, when a giant bunny walks up and starts humping your leg, it's really kind of, there's no hiding it at that point.
All right. That is the moment when we need to move on. Evan, what do you got for this week?
All right. Here we go. This week, Who's That Noisy? Coming up, it's quick, so be ready.
I saw Bigfoot.
That's it.
I know what it is. I know exactly what it is.
That's Jay at the bar last night.
Nope.
Go ahead and post your answer on our forum. Send us an email at info@theskepticsguide.org. And of course, Jay, you say it.
Good luck, everybody.
All right, thanks, Ev. We're going to do one quick email this week. This email comes from Andy Speedy. It's a very quick email.
Sorry.
Quick.
And Mr. Speedy writes,
that's it.
Hello, guys. Hello from, or hey, guys. Hello from Scotland. I'm sure you get loads of these emails, but I know you'd like to hear about younger skeptics. My 16-year-old sister has been an avid listener since I introduced her to your show about a year ago. She recently set up her own blog at Skeptene, it's SCEPTEEN.blogspot.com, and is tackling a variety of skeptical-themed issues aimed at a younger audience. Her goal is to become a journalist, and the skeptical training you have been providing is going to be great preparation for this. If you have the time, I would highly recommend having a look. Her article on homeopathy is particular, deserves a read. Her standard of writing is excellent, and I'm really proud of her. Anyway, I don't know if it is possible, but she would be over the moon to get a mention on the show. I've not told her that I'm emailing you to save her a disappointment if you're not able to oblige. Thanks
Smart
for taking
move.
The time to read this. All the best. Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry, Andy. We're not going to have time to read the email or to give a shout-out or a plug to your sister.
Next time.
We're busy skeptics.
You know, so,
we got stuff to do.
Actually, my moderator, my admin at teenskeptic.org has already sent her an email asking her if she would like to participate in Teen Skeptic.
Awesome.
So she can possibly reach an even larger audience, but I'm sure we're going to send a lot of listeners
and
her way.
Her, by the way, is Becky, B-E-C-C-Y, which
it's a perfect
was
name.
Not
it's
named
good.
In the email.
Becky.
Hey, Becky. Thanks.
It's a good name.
Hey, Rachel.
She's just getting started with the whole skeptical blogging thing. I do have a few, after looking at her website, a few words of advice. One is you need an About the Author page. There's sort of nowhere on your blog where I could know who you are and what's going on. If there is, I missed it, and it needs to be more prominent. Your writing is excellent. The topics are all fairly generic topics, which is fine. You got to get started somewhere. I do recommend that you find a niche. Could be anything. This is sort of my generic advice to new skeptical bloggers. People ask me all the time if they, you know, what they should do. And I think from what I've seen, the people who are the most successful are those who find some angle that they can call their own. Some slice of the skeptical community that they are the go-to person about, where their blog is a lead on.
One thing I think is great is if you're able to focus on teens.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that obviously Teen Skeptic is for. It's because we looked around and we saw that there was this huge swath of people who weren't really getting information that was relevant to their life because everything's being done by people who are in their 30s or up. So, I would say if you're going to write about something, write about what's going on in your life and what's relevant to you and what you think is going to be relevant to your peers, because we really need more of that.
Right. But always glad to welcome a new young skeptic into the fold. Well, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fiction. and you all can play along at home.
If you want.
No pressure.
No pressure.
Hit fast forward.
Okay, here they are. Item number one. A new fossil analysis has led paleontologists to conclude that an early human relative, Paranthropus boisei, mostly grazed on grass. Item number two, researchers have discovered a method for converting bad white fat into healthy brown fat. And item number three, inventors have unveiled a new personal computer made out of what is essentially paper. Rebecca, you haven't gone first in a while. You go first.
Okay, so an early human relative grazed on grass for the most part. I can understand that. We have that appendix that's supposed to have done something or other, and maybe its purpose was digesting things that we don't currently eat, things like grass, which is very difficult to digest. At least that's the rumor I heard years and years ago from some random person. So for all I know, that's completely false. But for the moment, at least, that jibes with what I understand about human ancestry. Converting bad white fat into healthy brown fat. That's interesting. I haven't heard anything about this. I did hear something about some study that said if you get liposuction, it all comes back immediately. That's like the only fat news I heard this week.
I heard that too, Rebecca. That's funny. I heard that as well.
I read that article.
Yeah. So I don't know if you're just trying to be tricky. Maybe if I'd read that article in depth, it would have sounded something like this. I don't know. But that's the only fat thing I can think of. And then making a personal computer out of paper. Okay. So to me, I'm not the smartest person in the world, which isn't news to you. So personal computers are, to me, mostly magic at this point, and regardless of what material they're made of. So because of that, I can completely believe that the magicians who make personal computers could make one out of what is essentially paper. And it's the essentially part that convinces me that that could likely be true. So it's essentially paper. Well, wood is essentially paper. There's a lot of things that are essentially paper that I'm sure could be rigged to work in a situation like that. So basically what I'm saying is that I haven't heard anything about any of these news items this week. And so it's kind of a stab in the dark, but I'm going to say that researchers have not, in fact, found a method for converting white fat into brown fat.
Okay, Evan?
I'll start with the first one, in which I've never heard of this relative before. The last name's interesting, B-O-I-S-E-I, I think Boise, Idaho, when I read of that. I don't know what to make of that, to tell you the truth. That one could
moo.
Obviously be either, but yes, they are moo people. They are cows. So moving on to the second one.
It's the noise your mother made last night.
Moving on.
Wouldn't that be great if we really could convert white fat into brown fat? I mean, but what is the method? I mean, maybe they did find a method, but, you know, the method causes problems in the process.
Right.
But it may be just a piece of the puzzle, maybe a step along the way. It's interesting. And then the last one, the personal computer made out of what is essentially paper. Well, when I think of paper and I think of computers, I think of the punch card system, right? So was that technically a computer made out of paper?
No.
We're talking... No.
Bob, it's not your turn.
That was just a storage medium, essentially, and it was a way to put programming into the computer, but it wasn't the actual thing that computes. Shouldn't be talking right now, should I?
Well, it does help me. I don't. It's either the one with grass or it's the one about the fat. I'm going to say... Which one do you think it is, Rachel? Okay, my daughter thinks that it's the one about fat, that one's the fiction, so that's the one I'm going to go with. Thank you, Rachel.
Okay, Jay?
The one about the new fossil analysis, I have no reason to really think that that isn't true, so I just don't know, but that sounds absolutely plausible. The one about the white fat and the brown fat, if out of the three of these, if I had to pick one, I have to pick this one as the fake for lots of reasons. One, I'm thinking that the difference between those two fats... Converting one fat into the other doesn't seem really plausible. I bet you that it's not a minor difference between the two. I'm guessing, of course, but I'm just using my gut to help me here. I'd imagine that there's something significant about them, much more than, say, things that are easy to change, like the size or whatever.
I think it goes much deeper than that. So I'm going to say that one's the fake.
Okay, Bob.
All right. I'll start with three. Personal computer made out of what is essentially paper. Yeah, I think Rebecca nailed it. Essentially is a key word there. I could easily envision doping paper with some minor amount of something, perhaps carbon nanotubes, and make a basic computer. So yeah, that's fine. One and two though are really difficult. For number two, a brown fat, or it's brown adipose tissue, BAT, is amazing stuff. It's really, it's called fat, but it's really so metabolically active. It's one of the reasons why kids seem to have so much energy. And, if we had more of it, it would be a fantastic thing. And this would be quite an advance. There's actually brown adipose tissue is kind of dispersed throughout the body in tiny little beads of fat. I think there's some like behind your neck is one classic place where this brown adipose tissue is. If you could take it all together and put it together, you'd have like this organ of brown fat that is actually really important, but you actually, I think you lose it as you age, to help maintain it. Exercise helps maintain it. If we could actually, convert white fat into brown fat, that would be almost too good to be true. And Jay, you're right. I think there would be, not a minor amount of change required to actually make that happen. And Rebecca, you mentioned something about sucking out fat and having it be replaced. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me because when you suck out fat, you're sucking out the cells. The cells are gone, which is a great way to lose fat because those cells you don't make new cells once you're mature.
Yeah, the downside is
other cells would get bigger, of course.
Yeah, so you change your fat distribution, which could be
right.
Odd.
Right.
And what happens, Bob, is like people end up getting fat deposits in really strange places. Then, like your eyeball, you know,
it
just doesn't look right.
Ew.
So there's Ew, that, and then the first one. This makes no sense to me either because I wish I knew how far back that these Paranthropus boisei goes back. I'm not sure how far they go back, but subsisting on grass makes no sense to me at all because grass has like almost no nutrition. You would have to really change your entire digestive system to deal with grass. So I don't think boisei doesn't go back that far, I don't think. Oh, but then there's that word mostly. Perhaps they could have eaten grass and then had some other key intake of nutrients.
They only come out at night, mostly.
Wait, you got to say mostly twice, Jay. So those two are really tough to decide between. Mostly grass. I'll go with the crowd and say that converting the white fat into brown is just a little bit too good to be true, and I think it would be pretty difficult to actually do a conversion from one into the other. Wait a second. What if you can convert the white fat cells back into stem cells and oh boy shit. All right, I'll just go with the brown fat one. I'll say that's fiction.
Okay. I'll take these in order then.
I love you, Bob.
A new fossil analysis has led paleontologists to conclude that an early human relative, Paranthropus boisei, mostly grazed on grass. You guys all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Huh? Oh, wow! Yes.
Cool. So far, so good.
I'm shocked.
Yeah. So this species is currently dated from 2.3 to 1.2 million years ago. Probably early. Not a direct human ancestor, which is why I said relative and not ancestor, but a hominin and on the tree there somewhere.
The hobbit.
And you can analyze the carbon isotopes in the teeth. And that will tell you what they mostly subsisted on because there are different kinds
awesome.
Of food that would produce different ratios of isotopes.
I thought it would be the wear on the teeth.
Well, they do have big honking grazing teeth that could be used to grind tough food. But were they eating nuts or were they eating leaves and grass?
Mm. Awesome.
This showed that about 77% of the diet of P. boisei came from tropical grasses. So had its diet was more similar to grazers like zebras than it was to other primates who ate a lot of fruits, leaves, and nuts.
So how wide a variety of food is grass? I mean, it's probably pretty wide. You can probably get some decent
still,
nutrition
it is.
Out of it.
It's still grasses. You know, it's still
right. Bamboo is a type of grass, but still, yeah, you're right. The nutrition, though. I mean, what
got to eat
a lot of it.
Where's
the protein coming from? Yeah, you need a lot of it. But where's the protein coming from if it's mostly grass?
Well, Bob, cows live off of grass.
I know, and that's why I mentioned that their digestion is so different from ours, and they eat so much of it. Yeah, it's like, yeah, I just had a hard time imagining.
But, I mean, an early human relative could have a very different digestive tract, couldn't it?
All right, do you guys want me to read number two next or number three next?
Two.
Doesn't matter.
Okay, researchers have discovered a method for converting bad white fat into healthy brown fat. You guys all think that this is the fiction, and this is science.
What?
Oh, I knew as soon as you asked us which we wanted.
Holy shit.
Yeah. You bastard.
Shocked.
Wow.
Stymied.
Yeah, very nice. These were scientists who were studying a new potential drug. Scientists from the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And they were looking at rats with silenced NPY expression. So this is suppressing a protein which is involved with appetite. So the thinking was these rats would eat less and they would lose weight, and they did. But when they examined their body fat, they found that the percentage of brown fat to white fat had significantly increased, which would not happen just as a consequence of losing weight. So there was some other effect going on here that was causing that to occur. Guys, it's actually not that implausible that one type of cell can turn into another related type of cell. That cells actually can respond to hormones, for example. Let me give you an example from neurology that I'm familiar with. The type of muscle cells that you have, you know that there are
slow twitch and fast twitch.
Yeah, type 1 and type 2 muscle fibers are determined by the cell, the nerve that innervates them. And if you have injury and then recovery, so that a new neuron will innervate those muscle fibers, they'll turn into type 1 or type 2 depending on what type of neuron innervates them.
That's cool.
What does innervate mean?
The nerve connects to and then will fire that muscle, right? So the nerve controls the muscle, and the nerve also determines whether it's type 1 or type 2. Maybe that's what's going on here. That'd be one hypothesis. I don't know that they proved that it wasn't a selective loss of white fat over brown fat. I guess that wouldn't really explain what they found, though. So there had to be some increase in the amount of brown fat. And they interpret that as sort of converting some of the white fat into brown fat.
I mean, what's one of the key differences, though? I'm not even sure. Is it the amount of mitochondria in the cells?
Well, I'm sure that probably is different, but it's mainly their brown fat is more metabolically active. So it burns calories.
I'm trying to figure out why.
Yeah, and the thinking is that it contributes to maintaining body temperature. That's why it's there, to burn energy to create heat. So it's a good way to waste energy. Yeah,
that's another one of the reasons why kids can, in the middle of the winter, they kick off their covers because they're warm, because their brown fat is just producing so much heat.
And you're right, we do tend to lose brown fat as we age.
Yeah,
just one of the many wonderful things that happens to our bodies as we age. Yeah. All right, which means inventors have unveiled a new personal computer made out of what is essentially paper is fiction.
Why didn't
you
I read? Why didn't I fully read that damn article?
Bob, you got the headline thing again. Yeah, here's the headline that I saw: revolutionary new paper computer shows flexible future for smartphones and tablets.
Yeah, that's what I read.
I'd like to say I didn't even read it, so you got me.
I love these because I always get caught by these headlines. I'm like, really, what's really going on here? And it's different than what the headline. Of course, that's always perfect, because if you don't read past the headline, you're going to get snookered. So it's a normal computer, but the display is a flexible e-ink display. But the computer is still a computer. So it's very misleading, a paper computer. It's just like
you can tear your screen.
Imagine it's a smartphone, but you have the one part of it is the computer, and then instead of the glass and rigid display, there's it looks really more like plastic than anything else, but it's a flexible e-ink display. The thinking is it'd be more portable, it'd be more comfortable, it'd fit better into your pocket. And then they are looking to unveil this pretty soon. It actually looks pretty cool. I'd like to get my hands on one and see what they're really like. Again, I think it's one of those things where, of course the guy who invented it and who's promoting it thinks it's the best things in sliced bread. But until people start try to use it, it's hard to know if it will be annoying or if it really will be useful, or maybe people don't mind having rigid iPhones. I don't know. We'll see. It's a good experimentation, though, to see if these kinds of products will be useful and desirable.
You tricky bastard.
Good
You've
job,
made
Steve.
A lot of enemies today, Steve.
And wow. You haven't done that in a while,
and
dude.
And loving it. Yeah, I'm definitely overdue for the clean sweep. I thought you were going to get it, Bob, and then you were going to reverse your fortunes from last week.
Yeah, for a moment there, Bob nearly went the other way.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But I think the paper computer was always in.
Yeah, nobody, yeah. So.
Yes. Yep, I totally bought that one. Hook, line, and sinker.
Mm-hmm. And he essentially just gave it plausible deniability.
So we have to congratulate Steve instead of him congratulating
yes,
someone.
You have to congratulate
Yeah,
me.
Congratulations.
Yeah, whatever.
Good job, Steve.
Thank you, guys.
It's good work, boy.
Jay, get away from me, kid. You're bothering me.
Jay, give me a quote.
This is a quote sent in from a listener named Mark Lloyd in Barrie, Ontario. Hey, Mark, do you know Mike Lassell?
Yeah, he's in
He can't answer. He's not actually on the show.
He lives in Canada, right?
So the quote is from a man named Robert Sapolsky. And Robert Maurice Sapolsky, born 1957, is an American scientist and author. He is currently professor of biological sciences and professor of neurology and neurological sciences and, by courtesy, neurosurgery at Stanford University.
So you know him, Steve.
You know. He's a friend of yours, right?
Yeah. You guys all hang out in the same cafeteria or wherever.
Robert said so eloquently, "I love science, and it pains me to think that so many are terrified of the subject or feel that choosing science means you cannot also choose compassion or the arts or be awed by nature. Science is not meant to cure us of mystery, but to reinvent and reinvigorate it." Robert Sapolsky!
Yeah, that's a good quote like that.
Yeah.
It's a good quote,
Evan,
boys.
Do you have an announcement this week?
I do have an announcement. Our friends out on the West Coast are having a conference this month. Maybe you've heard of it. Skeptical 2011. The Skeptical 2011 conference is going to feature speakers including Dr. Eugenie Scott, Dr. Bob Carroll, Yao Man Chan, Mark Edward, Dr. Anthony Pratt-Canis, and others. So their website is skepticalcon.org. That's skepticalcon.org. So you should go ahead, visit the website, and get registered.
And there's a lot more going on in California in the weeks prior. I'm going to be in LA. I'm going to be speaking for the UCLA Skeptics Group on Friday the 13th, which I just realized is Friday the 13th. So maybe I'll make it superstition related. Actually, I think they're the UCLA atheists, but they're still skeptical of Friday the 13th, I'm sure.
UCL atheists.
And then on the 15th, I'm going to be speaking at the OC Free Thought Alliance's conference, in the OC. And then I'm going to San Francisco and I am speaking Wednesday night, the 18th for Jeannie Scott's Skeptics Group. I'm running a trivia show, like a big pub quiz. That'll be a lot of fun. And then on Sunday, the 22nd, I'm going to be in Oakland at the American Atheist Conference, speaking about how we all just got raptured and wasn't it great.
And it's probably a good time to mention, we haven't mentioned in a couple of weeks, that TAM9 from Outer Space, the amazing meeting July 14th through 17th, 2011, is open for registration. The SGU will be doing two live shows during the conference, as well as there will be a science-based medicine workshop. And we will be doing our SGU dinner. The spots do fill up and sell out quickly. So although we are planning on expanding the dinner this year, if you want to make sure you get a seat, I would register early. And I think it's moved to Saturday night this year. You typically do it Friday night, but now the SG dinner is going to be Saturday night so that it doesn't conflict with other events. Registration for that is through the regular registration for the conference through the JREF. And we will be doing an auction and there will be other entertainment at the SGU dinner.
What other entertainment do you need? It's us.
It's true.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining me again this week.
Yeah.
Surely.
Good times.
Let's do it. Let's do it again. Let's do it again next week.
Okay.
Maybe.
Yeah, we'll see if we have time.
Yeah.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.